You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 100.5 FM.
This past week, the Pivot Legal Society hosted an open forum entitled The Case for Heroin-Assisted Treatment in Canada. The evening began with a screening of a documentary made for Danish television called Anyone for Coffee and Heroin. The film documents life at the Poppy Clinic during its first year of operation in Copenhagen. Denmark is the first country to offer physician-prescribed heroin to the most profoundly addicted heroin users, and the Poppy Clinic is the first such clinic to open in Denmark. Besides providing heroin and a supervised injection site, the clinic also offers a safe space for users to interact with one another, as well as light meals and coffee. Members of the staff also help the users in finding work and a permanent place to live. Among the heroin users profiled in the film are one who was able to move into his very first apartment ever, and another who began to feel well enough to clean his apartment for the first time in 10 years. During the discussion, the panelists are asked about and mention the film several times. The panelists included Dr. Gabor Maté, author of the book In the Realm of Hungry Ghosts, Dr. Bruce Alexander, professor emeritus at Simon Fraser University and author of The Globalization of Addiction. Also in attendance was Dave Murray, who heads the Salome Naomi Association of Patients. This association is an independent group of participants of heroin-assisted clinical trials in the downtown east side of Vancouver from 2005 to 2013. And the group was rounded out with Scott Bernstein, a lawyer in charge of health and drug policy with the Pivot Legal Society, and he is also a member of the Red Eye Collective. The panel discussion was moderated by Connie Carter of the Canadian Drug Policy Coalition. Also referred to a number of times during the discussion is Rona Ambrose, who is Federal Minister for Health. Ms. Ambrose recently overturned a decision by Health Canada to allow continued use of heroin by prescription to the participants of the heroin-assisted clinical trials currently underway in Vancouver. The discussion began with the moderator, Connie Carter, asking each participant to comment on the Danish film Anyone for Coffee and Heroin, and the first to reply was Dave Murray.
It's different a little bit than what we have over here in at Salome and Naomi was, because here obviously it was a study, and they didn't have all the things that they had there. So it was quite interesting to see what a program, a clinic looked like for me, because the study's quite different. You know, it's much more regimented, and there's less, you know, like social aspects to it. Like how, like the housing thing was quite interesting, and you saw them getting together for meals and things. And it seemed very small, the clinic. You know, I think at the end it said, what was it? There was six clinics with 100 participants in six cities in Denmark. I've read afterwards that there was, I think it was, they were built for like 200 capacity, 200 or 300, I think it was. So they hadn't hit capacity at the time the film was made. So I think it would be great to have something like that here in Vancouver. I think it would benefit quite a few people.
Thanks, Dave. Dr. Maté, do you have any comments on the film?
Well, two. One is it gave me a sense of personal hope, because the guy in the film who hadn't cleaned his apartment for 10 years, I'm the same way, and I thought, maybe if I could go to one of these clinics, I would clean my room. But the other really is the point that the federal government absolutely misses, you know, that when they talk about recovery, they really think that there's some kind of contradiction between maintenance and heroin prescription on the one hand and recovery on the other. It's as if these things are somehow in opposition to one another. And what you saw in the film, of course, was striking, is that people start off wanting to get blasted. And then what they want towards the end is they want to lower their dose because they want to become more conscious. And they have the intention of actually making something of their lives. And so what the government really doesn't get here in Canada with its current policies is that their goal, and, you know, and I can well believe that their goal is recovery, is not in any way vitiated by an approach that involves giving people what they need when they need it. That in fact doing so will in the long term promote more recovery. And given how this recovery-based approach just is a complete and utter failure when it comes to many, many thousands of, tens of thousands of users, it's instructive to see in this film how the very fact of giving people their heroin actually leads them to wishing to use less and to be more productive in their own lives and contributing to society. So that contradiction really needs to be obliterated in people's consciousness.
Thank you. Dr. Alexander, do you have any comments on the film?
I'm hoping that the film will be shown at the Conservative Party conference. I think it's a great film, in my opinion, because I think that when they show it at the Conservative Party conference, they will realize that the people who are getting this kind of treatment are real human beings, and they have all kinds of anxieties like the rest of us, and they'll also realize that it doesn't work for everyone, but it works for a lot of people, and they can be told that this film just confirms really a century of knowledge. We talk about the fact that we have studied giving heroin to addicts in the last 10 or 15 years in Europe, but really, we've been doing it for a century. There's all kinds of really good historical information on it, and it all points to the same conclusion, which is that there are some people who will not get along very well unless they're offered this kind of treatment, and that it can work out very well, and often does work out very well. So I'm kind of grateful for this film.
Thank you. Scott, do you have anything you'd like to add?
I think everybody said it all. I wish Rhoda Ambrose was sitting in the room and watching it. And I'm not sure if she would change her mind on anything, but it's interesting to contemplate. I think the movie is. I liked it, and one of the reasons we wanted to bring it was just it's a really true to life and compassionate portrayal of people that are going through some really difficult times. But you get to see that people are sons and daughters and husbands and wives and mothers and fathers. And I think that's something that needs to be done. We need to really remove this stigma around what is essentially a physical condition that people go through.
Thank you.
I just had one comment, which is there's a phrase that I quote from the Egyptian novelist Naguib Mahfouz, who writes that nothing records the effects of a sad life as graphically as the human body. And when you look at these people in the film, the users, I mean, their sad lives are etched on their faces. And the one thing that addiction, the one thing that the film doesn't talk about, maybe it wasn't in its perspective to do so, and that's fair enough, but it's not accidental who ends up addicted. That's just important to acknowledge. That addiction isn't some genetic disease, and it's not a choice anybody makes. It's actually an outcome of trauma. And almost in every case, significant childhood trauma, abuse, sexual and otherwise. And you had a hint of that in the film, although the hint wasn't picked up on. When that guy in the film says that, who goes for therapy, and he talks about how he's ashamed of needing help. Well, that there he's telling the story of his childhood. Because nobody's born ashamed of needing help. Infants naturally cry for help. It's when help is denied and you're made to feel bad for the very need that you have. That's when you develop that shame. And that shame actually is a survival technique. Because it keeps you from asking help from people that aren't going to give it to you. Or might even hurt you if you do require help. Or if you make your choice up as vulnerable. And so I just wish that the politicians and actually the physicians who deal with addiction were more aware of just who they're dealing with when they're dealing with these people. Who they're dealing with is not just people who suffered because of addiction, but people who suffered in the first place, and that's why they become addicted in the second place.
Thank you. Another person has asked a question about methadone and what are the negative or unintended side effects of methadone, because this seems to be the criteria for most of these programs is that you have been on methadone and it hasn't worked for you in the past. And so I'm wondering if anyone on the panel wants to respond to that question specifically about methadone.
Well, methadone is a synthetic opiate, and it occupies the same molecular receptor sites on the surface of cells that other opiates might, so that it means that when you take methadone, you don't have withdrawal symptoms. As any opiate, it can have significant side effects such as sedation, dry mouth, constipation, all kinds of effects throughout the body, emotional problems, depression, and so on. Overdose can lead to somnolence and obviously even death. It can significantly impair your functioning if you have too much of it. But, you know, it's like with any medication. There's no medication that you can give that will not have potential side effects for some people. And this is the point that, again, that the government doesn't realize, is that Rondo Ambrose says that methadone is a good treatment for heroin use. Well, that's true some of the time. In fact, that's true a significant percentage of the time, that you can give somebody methadone. You haven't treated their addiction. They're still addicted. They're just addicted to something that you can take by mouth, and they're addicted to something that's legal. But it's like with any other medication. You have X number of antidepressants, but that there's some people with depression who simply will not respond to four different antidepressants. So you give them a fifth one. And the same with methadone. Some people just don't respond to methadone. Who knows what's different about their chemistry, what's different about their receptors. But there's something different about them, which means that when they get the methadone, it does not stop them from craving opiates. It does not stop the urgency of the opiate desire. And that's a small percentage of opiate addicts, but it's a significant percentage. And for those people, the methadone is simply inadequate, and then you have to give what will work. And what works for them is the heroin. There are also people for whom heroin doesn't work, as a matter of fact. In this case, we're talking about people for whom the methadone fails. It just fails. It just fails to satisfy. It fails to stop the behavior around addiction. So then they need the heroin.
Well,
Speaking from experience, I've been on methadone probably at least 10 times in my life. And I think the longest time was maybe for 8 or 9 months, but I never stopped using. I mean, I kept the dose to a low dose so that I could still feel the heroin, and I think the methadone was just an insurance so that I wouldn't be really sick. It didn't work for me ever.
Indeed. Thank you.
Connie, I'm wondering, can I ask a question?
Yes, absolutely.
So I'd actually like to ask it for Dave. I'm wondering if he would describe a little bit of some of the benefits he experienced being on the Naomi and the Salome study and changes, if you would.
Yeah, so I'll go really quick here because I did the Naomi study. It was from 2005 to 2008. I think I was about in the middle. And I got off, I think, around 2007. I went into a two-month downward spiral, right? I lost everything that I gained by being in the program and ended up homeless. Went to tried detox and treatment, and about 3 months, I kind of maintained it, slugged it out. But I went back to heroin over that winter. The next spring, I tried it again, went to treatment again. This time it kind of worked a lot better, and I kind of like struggled for a good nearly 3 years. It was a struggle, and eventually I went back to the my addiction again. It was where I found the solace and where I could function, you know, where it would make me feel okay. I know it's hard to understand for a lot of people. When we say this, a lot of people, it just made me feel all right, where I could function every day. I got back to my addiction again. I try it now. The new drug came out that was approved with Suboxone. So I went on Suboxone. That was okay for a little while, and then I slipped on that too. And Salome was coming up, so I applied, and I was in there. Now my 1 year's up, and they've got me on now this an oral liquid, oral hydromorphone, which is what they call Dilaudid. It's a painkiller. It's not really maintaining me very well. I use heroin now, again, street heroin. And I don't see much of a future doing this, of course. So I don't know. My future is up in air right now. I'm really...
Now, it's possible that the Saloma study will show that, which is Naomi's study indicated but didn't prove, that intravenous Dilaudid works as well as intravenous heroin.
Yeah,
and if it shows that, then maybe you might be a candidate for that later on, right?
Yeah, maybe, but I'm saying the oral is not really...
The oral is not doing it, yeah.
No.
Thank you. I'm grouping the questions a little bit here because there's lots of questions. And so I think there's several questions here that ask about or pick up on attention itself in the film around the rightness of this approach. And I think even the staff members are struggling a little bit in the film to try to answer some of the questions that are being posed to them about this. So I'm going to actually ask you, Dr. Alexander, if you want to comment on what's the struggle behind whether or not this is the right thing to do? What do you think is given your familiarity with the history of drug policy, what do you think is going on there?
Well, it is indeed very interesting in the film that the nurses are actually hesitant about this, and of course they know all the pharmacology and they have lots of clinical experience, and yet they are. And I think the reality is that we are in a particular cultural position where we've all been bombarded all our lives with incredible stories about certain drugs and including heroin, and it's almost impossible not to take them seriously. And this is an obstacle for any kind of rational treatment. What I have learned, however, from decades actually of teaching pharmacology courses and addiction courses at SFU, is that if you get people together in a room for a semester and it's simply tell them the facts. I mean, it's not necessary to embroider the facts or over-dramatize the facts or anything, but just simply tell them the facts. By the end of a semester, virtually everybody understands that, you know, heroin is a drug. It's like other drugs. It's like Dilaudid, and it's like, well, all the rest of the opiates. They're really all in the same family. They do the same things, and the panic disappears. But it requires that long. You know, it requires a lengthy exposure to simple facts and clinical studies and reports of people who are not addicted, have taken heroin experimentally, and all this stuff. There's a huge, huge, huge body of information, which if it were only public, we would be able to, I think, demystify and de-demonize heroin and therefore be able to treat it rationally. What is the encouraging part of this is that, you know, people will learn this in a few weeks. The discouraging part of it is that the demonization goes back literally a century, and that the same arguments. I mean, reading Rona Ambrose's little speech about Vancouver and prescribing heroin is kind of dismal because that same kind of speech was being given in the 1920s, literally. Mm-hmm. The 1920s, the 1930s, the 1940s. The demonization of this drug is a very, very long established thing, but we can get over it. And that's why I think I'm really honored to be here in the rubric of the Pivot Legal Society and all the wonderful people in the downtown East Side and Gabor in particular, who have over the decades have moved us quite far from the levels of extreme panic and just absolutely crazy demonization that we had in the 70s and 80s towards a slightly more rational approach, but we've still got a long way to go. And I'm hoping you guys are all going to keep doing what you're doing because you're doing a great job, but it won't be fast.
I'd just like to. I wanted to add to something about what the Danes went through to get this. They didn't have a study in Denmark. They went straight to program, and the most recent evidence that they had to rely on was Naomi. The evidence that came out from Naomi, it was published in I think 2008, and I mean here the Canadian government spent $10 million on Naomi. And all the results of it then sat on their hands and did nothing with it. Yet the Danish people benefited from it.
Mm-hmm. So it's kind of yeah.
And incidentally, if you want to go to what happened in Europe, the Swiss actually had a referendum on heroin assisted treatment, where it was overwhelming. The population voted for it as a treatment program, and I think they have 23 cities in Switzerland where heroin assisted treatment is a ongoing program. Over 1,500 clients.
Yeah, it's interesting that you should raise this question about, I mean, Dr. Alexander, you refer to it, Dave, you've referred to the question too, that there's been over 8 randomized controlled trials on the success of heroin-assisted treatments. And for those of you who don't know, randomized controlled trials are the sort of top of the sort of hierarchy in terms of research that's looked at as being the sort of the most legitimate. So the evidence behind this is very strong. So the medical evidence behind this is very strong. And I think to some extent the people in the film make a really good case that this is also the right thing to do ethically. And so a number of you are asking questions that get at, if we know this, then why don't we do this differently? Why don't we just make this more broadly available? And so I'm wondering what your thoughts are on that question, because I think that gets at something that we've been sort of skirting around a little bit, which is what's at stake here in terms of offering these kinds of treatments, and where is this resistance coming from?
Well, as a physician, one always hears the phrase evidence-based practice, that what you do medically ought to be based on the facts and research and so on. Now, I only wish that that's how medicine was practiced. There's so many areas in which it isn't, actually. But at least the principle is paid more than lip service to. Now, one might also wish the same in politics, that there should be evidence-based politics. Can you imagine what social policy would look like towards the environment, towards minorities, towards troubled families? And certainly in the realm of drug policy, if there was actually evidence-based. I mean, the evidence supports none of what's currently policy, and supports a completely different approach. So when the facts on the one hand and the policy on the other are in such contradiction, you really have to ask what's going on. Mm-hmm. And what's going on here is not an intellectual argument. I mean, it's true that you will find a couple of doctors here and there who argue against prescription heroin, argue against harm reduction and so on. I mean, you get ideological biases in every profession. But on the whole, on the part of the practicing physicians, you just don't get any disagreement, not significantly, and not any large numbers. What we have here is a government, and all governments are that way, but this one is particularly that way. This government is particularly ideologically based. They have an ideology that I could speculate on where it stems from. I rather suspect that when I look at the Prime Minister, I know where it comes from. That man is emotionally dead. You can see it in his eyes. He is a traumatized person who's completely shut down against his own trauma, and he hates vulnerability because he was so hurt when he was so vulnerable. He attacks vulnerability wherever he sees it. So you can say that that has an emotional base to it. More broadly, that emotional-based denial of reality shows up as an ideology, an ideology of moralism and control and judgment and righteousness. And they actually think that somehow they're Christians. I mean, they have no idea what Christ has anything to say about anything. if they actually think that way. But they base it on this very narrowly conceived ideological basis, and precisely because ideology is based on emotional defenses and not on facts, therefore the facts do not penetrate. So there's simply no arguing, there's no presenting facts, there's no presenting evidence, there's no research-based practice, there's nothing that in any way resembles rational discourse. And so I'm afraid that one can say that, but the solution is not how to convince these people. You cannot convince these people. Not because they're not decent human beings or they mean to be, but simply because they're so shut down and so defended against reality that the reality doesn't penetrate into the realm of their thinking. Unfortunately, they happen to run this country. And that's what we've got. And which also means that, I was going to ask Scott this, I mean, you know, it's just so frustrating that every time there is some decent thing that you can do to help the most vulnerable and the most hurt, what Dostoevsky would have called the insulted and the injured, every time there's something you can find you can do for them, the government says, no, you can't do this. And then you have to go to court just so that you can do the decent thing that science supports. What a crazy world that for the sake of sanity and science, you have to go to court every time. So my question is, are we going to court on this one?
It's a good question. Scott?
Yes. Stay tuned shortly. Okay. I think we're looking at legal options, and I think you know, definitely we can't sit by and let these harmful regulations stand without challenging them. And I think I think definitely.
And I think it's fair to say, based on how this has taken place at the level of both federal politicians and Federal Health Canada officials, that they've left themselves wide open.
If I may, I'd like to pick up on the resistance question.
Yes,
too.
Please do.
Because I agree with Gabor. I don't think anyone's going to convince Stephen Harper of anything, but I think that it's very important that the information and the case studies and the films like this get out, because the change is going to come from the bottom up. This, unfortunately, is, I guess, the history of our times. The good changes are coming from the bottom up. And if we look at Vancouver over the past 50 years, we have seen an incredible change in the way people here think. I mean, most of you are too young to know what Vancouver was like in the 1960s and 70s, but it was a brutal place for any kind of drug addict. I mean, brutal in a way that you know, we don't see it anymore. And people were spending most of their lives in the BC Pen and Ocala and getting brutalized on the way in and while they're there and on the way out. That's changed. It's changed a lot. The public opinion has changed significantly, not enough. And we still have the kind of the demon drug fear that lingers and makes it difficult to be rational. But the change in public opinion is so marked that I think that's where the hope lies. It's not a matter of convincing Stephen Harper. It's just a matter of not voting for him. And I think I think that will happen.
Thank you. I think a number of you have also are asking a set of questions that speak to what would a program. So if we didn't have the kinds of barriers that we have right now, if we move beyond the clinical trial phase, what would a program in, say, Vancouver or Toronto or Montreal look like? And so I'm wondering if I could invite, perhaps starting with Dave, members of the panel to muse on what kind of, for starters, what kind of legal and regulatory framework would enable this sort of program to take place without the substantive barriers that we currently have? Like, what kinds of changes might we need to make this happen? Getting rid of Harper.
Sure. So actually, it's quite simple. There's, you know, a federal approval. They schedule drugs in different categories, and the first hurdle now is that heroin is not approved for any any use outside of a clinical study in Canada. And so the first thing is the government simply lists it as part of the pharmacopoeia that doctors can use to prescribe, and then doctors prescribe it. And so on one spectrum, you could have a program where a doctor prescribes heroin to an individual patient. What we've been looking at now are models with this film and through the clinical studies are models of supervised prescription where people go to an actual physical space and receive syringes filled with a predetermined amount of heroin or given that. And so what the government has done now with the regulations is they've taken off the table some of the mechanisms that we might need to import heroin into the country and get it into the hands of clinical pharmacies and clinical doctors. And they've also cut off access, particularly for the people exiting the Salome study, to have this access through the special access program where they can be continued in care.
Anybody else want to answer that one? Because I have another question. Some other people are also asking about, and I think this is it's interesting that you've detected this from the film. There's more going on in the clinic space in the film than just the prescription of heroin. Mm-hmm. So if we were to imagine a similar situation here in Canada, what might be the ideal setting in terms of services?
I mean, we already have that just a few blocks away, really. I mean, if you go to Insight, which is designed, of course, as a place where, no thanks to the federal government, but thanks to thanks to Scott and the Pivot Legal and other people, where people bring in their drugs to be inject, it's not just about injecting drugs. People get coffee, people are talked with, people are engaged with, people are treated like human beings, and especially given that people have not been treated like human beings all their lives, since their childhoods, when you are, that actually gives you a different sense of yourself. That gives you a different sense of how you can be in the world. It gives you a sense of a different possibility for yourself. So the model, I don't think, the model is very nice to what we saw in Denmark, but I don't think that we have much to learn from it, except in the sense that it validates what is happening a few blocks over here in Insight. And that's simply what one of these clinics would look like, is a place where people come and are allowed to be human beings, and where they can begin to experience some of their own human potential.
Yeah.
There's another treatment model, which is, I think, very Canadian. And it's one which I learned about in the 1970s because I was working with a group of people who were fighting against the BC government at that point, which was trying to essentially put the methadone program out of existence or to put so many restrictions on it that it wouldn't work. And so a group of us were fighting back against that. And in the process of doing that, I got to meet quite a number of Vancouver doctors who wanted to talk to me and to my colleagues about their prescribing. And these were generally speaking family doctors, and they were in most cases prescribing morphine to heroin addicts. And you would need to know that for most, or many, most, I think, heroin addicts, morphine is a very, very good, acceptable substitute. These were regular doctors who had a regular practice, but some of their patients were, for whatever reason, needed to have these prescriptions, and they were doing it. And it wasn't legal, but it wasn't really illegal because the police and the medical association were willing to just look the other way and not make much of a fuss about it, because everybody could see that this was just being done for the right reason, and it was, generally speaking, working out very well. I think that there's lots of room in Canada, in our history, for doctors having just a few patients, and we could hope to go back to that.
Right.
A number of you are asking a set of questions that get at, I think, what might be some, shall we say, unexamined power relationships that are evident in the film. So I'm going to put this one to you, Dave. So if we were talking about an ideal setting in which we would offer these kinds of treatments, what would we want of staff who work in those kinds of settings? What do we need to do better?
In the film, you saw that how the people were reacting to the staff. They were loving, caring people, and they wanted to, you know, make people's lives better. It's I mean, we all saw the film there. The guy who didn't clean his house, and there was the other one who never had a house, and so they were helping them get all these things together. I noticed in the film there was a kitchen. They were having food together and all that. These are things that could be in a program. I remember we had a guy here from Sweden, and he came over once during just before the Olympics, and he described how they were doing the methadone in Sweden, and it was this umbrella kind of thing, a one-stop shop where the people would come and get their substitution treatment, which was, they were talking about methadone at the time, but there was housing, there was some people there to help with mental health problems, there was, it was a whole bunch of things that were offered. All the social services were offered under one roof, and it seemed to work quite well. I thought that might be and I think that would be what a kind of program would morph into here. And I think that's what it's what is happening in Denmark too. And you've got to remember, Denmark, that's the beginning of it. I mean, we could look at that in a few years from now, and it might be even more comprehensive.
Another set of questions that people are wondering about is about the question of, and Dave, you just touched on this very briefly, and I wanted to come back to it. What do we need here in terms of, like, it seems to me that the provision of prescription heroin is part of the puzzle, but and as you said from the clinic itself, there are other things going on in the clinic, but a number of people are asking about what other kinds of things need to happen around that. So you just talked about the fellow in the film who's trying to find a home and some other stuff. And I'm just wondering if the panel wants to comment on some of the other things that are at stake here in terms of what we need to provide.
Well, the one thing that's missing from the film, and it's not a critique of what they're doing there, but I think what's necessary is nobody uses for trivially. I mean, I don't know what happened to you in your life, Dave, but you didn't wake up one morning and said, my ambition is to become a heroin-dependent person. That's not how it started. And, you know, you talked about how it makes you feel, and let me just ask you, I mean, how does it make you feel when you take the heroin? How does it make you feel?
Well, you're right, Dr. Mathey. I didn't wake up one day and say, hey, I want to become a heroin addict and, well, give up my family, my friends, everything I ever owned, and end up homeless on the corner. No, it's not something that I've never spoke to anyone that's what they seeked out. It's something that their life experiences have led them to. This is the only thing that actually makes them being able to, myself included, to live and to function in society somehow.
So what is it that, I don't mean to be too personal, but what is it that it gives you? What's the feeling that it gives you that allows you to be okay?
Well, I've read your book, so so I know about the warm, soft hug. I can say.
So really, it gives you peace of mind.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Okay. Yes.
Peace of mind. So in other words, what people are after is what we all are after. Uh-huh. People addicted to substances, they just want what everybody else wants, which is peace of mind and mm-hmm. connection and a whole bunch of other things, and what the film does not explore. And it wasn't its purview necessarily, but the clinic doesn't seem to engage them in that kind of discussion. I know it's the beginning, so I'm not critiquing it, but I'm saying what's also necessary.
Yeah.
What would also be necessary is an exploration of what that's all about for people. Mm-hmm. Like, if you don't have peace of mind, how come you don't have it? If you don't have a sense of connection, what happened? And what else can we help you bring into your life that would give you that peace of mind, that would give you that sense of connection, so that you're not relying completely on the drug to do it for you. Mm. So that conversation was missing from the film, and in any center that's established around substance use, I'd like to see that in there of helping people identify what they get from the use, what led them there, and how they can gain those qualities in their lives without the drugs or in addition to the drugs, so that they're not relying only on the drugs. And I think that's what would help people gradually let go of it. So that exploration, I think, is... And unfortunately, and this is just the sad fact, is that physicians are not trained to think that way. So that it's entirely possible for somebody to see addiction physicians for decades and never be asked what happened to them in their lives. It's astonishing, but that's just how it is. And even nurses and so on. I mean, the nurses that gravitate to working in the downtown east side are a very particular group. Mm-hmm. And so are the physicians very often. But by and large, in the healthcare professions, there's not that awareness of how people's life experiences lead them to certain behaviors, so that there's very little in the training of healthcare professionals that helps people explore and maybe get past, let go of those emotional patterns and all that. So that needs... What I'm saying is people need a lot of compassionate support, counseling, and a lot of listening to. They need to be listened to a lot. And whether they do that at the center or not, but it just wasn't evident that that's one of their goals.
Yeah, I would want to pick up on that and go a step farther, even to say that it's really important here that we bear in mind the limits of professional service. I mean, we can have the kind of professional service that Gabor is describing there, and that'll be great. But what we really need, of course, is for people who are in such a center to be able to go out into the street, into a welcoming community, into a society that they can trust, into a world which is stable and makes sense. And there's a limit even to harm reduction and even to heroin assisted treatment. There's a limit to what can be done, because the kind of addiction that we talk about here, this heroin addiction, is of course simply the tip of a much larger iceberg of addiction, which is all of our problems, and it's a problem which is a societal problem rather than an individual problem. And I just think it's important to say this, that whereas we're all here because we have great hopes for harm reduction and for heroin-assisted treatment in this case, and me too, but it's never going to be enough. We have to look at the larger problem, and we're only going to do that when we get past kind of the Rona Ambrose approach to thinking about drugs and just thinking about them in a more level-headed way. And just why is it that we are an addicted society? That problem is next on the agenda, I think, once we take care of the little problem of the war on drugs.
Thank you. I'm aware that we're running out of time, but that's a perfect segue into our last question, which is a number of people asked about the legal context of all of this. And I think the question that they're asking is, what role does prohibition play in contributing to the situation that we find ourselves in right now in terms of whether it's barriers to access to HAT or anything else? Well, I know it's a doozy, sorry.
Any number. Bruce can answer this beautifully because, his book on the subject is still a classic, and I'm sure Scott has something to say. The only thing I'll add to it medically is that if you look at the literature on stress, what is it that stresses people? What stresses people is loss of control, uncertainty, lack of information, and conflict. This is what stresses people. And exclusion and isolation. These are the stressors. These are the stressors that trigger the body's stress response mechanism. So you get high stress hormone levels. Now, when you get high stress hormone levels, one of the ways to soothe them is through addictive behaviors. So whether you do this to laboratory animals or whether you do it to human beings, when their stress hormone level goes up, they want to be using something to soothe themselves. So those of you that might have an eating problem, for example, when you're most likely to go home and binge eat is when you're stressed. So this is the literature on stress. Okay? Great. So imagine now a group of geniuses in Ottawa or Washington thinking about how do we tackle the problem of drugs? Oh, they say. Well, we know from the research literature that the most significant trigger for addictive relapse is stress. And we also know that the most significant triggers for stress is isolation, conflict, uncertainty, loss of control, uncertainty. I know, let's exclude these people. Let's make their lives totally uncertain. Let's engage them in all kinds of conflict. Let's ostracize them. That will surely get them to give up their drugs. In other words, the war on drugs, if you had to design a system that is going to keep a lot of people addicted and entrench them in their addictions and make it difficult for them to leave it behind, you would design exactly the system that we have right now. It's really that simple.
Thank you. Dave, I think we're done for tonight, but I think on that happy note, since you live at ground zero of this one, I'd like to give you the last word.
Oh, gee, no, please. I'll pass it to Scott.
I'm going to get my last word. I'm going to get my last word after you.
Oh, okay.
You take the second to last word, though.
Oh, no, so I'm sitting here hoping that Rona Ambrose, it would be nice if she was here, but she was here about a week ago, and she said something about, they asked her if she was visit Insight, but she said she had a plane to catch. She said maybe the next time she comes. I think we should find out the next time she comes, and we should all go down there and tell her exactly what we want here. We want the government to start listening to science and stuff and this ideology, this crazy ideology that they have, and we'll move right on there. I think we have to listen to the stories, and the stories of the people, I hear them every day. I formed a group of patients' associations so the patients could have a voice of their own. Salome Naomi Association of Patients, and we meet every Saturday up at Vandu. And I think that it's important that we be able to tell our stories and our stories get out there. And we'd like the government to listen to them, but I don't think that's quite on the agenda yet. But I think what moved it forward in Denmark, the place we just watched on the film there, was them telling stories of the people that were excluded in their society in Denmark, and the people looked at it and said, no, we can't do that. There's a little film on YouTube. It's called Waiting for a Legal Shot. You can just ask for that, and it's about 6 minutes. And it tells the story of how they got it, the program in Denmark without going to a study. And they tell the story. They told the story of a woman who was excluded from society, and she was selling sex, and how she was she found that she took methadone and a bunch of benzos. It was kind of like heroin, but the benzos were given to her by this old 71-year-old guy who was like a necrophiliac, and he'd wait till she had given her so many of them that she'd just be right out of it. Anyway, this story went on the news in Denmark, and they show frontal nudity and stuff like this in Denmark is quite common, and they showed this in the 6 o'clock news. Well, the next day the phones were ringing off the hook in the parliament, telling them, "You do something about this," you know, and that's what moved it forward in Denmark. I don't know if we have to go to that here, but that was what started in the thing in Denmark. It's an interesting little film. It's only 6 minutes. Waiting for a Legal Shot. Yeah.
Thank you to our panelists. I think we're going to turn it over to Scott for the final word for tonight, and thank you to all of you for your brilliant questions. And over to you, Scott.
So with some luck and maybe some interesting words and skills, you're now motivated to take action to support evidence-based treatment over ideology. If that's the case, then I encourage you to not let tonight be the end of your engagement on this important issue. In the recent throne speech, the federal government threw down the gauntlet on each of PIVOT's campaign areas. They refused to take meaningful action on housing and homelessness. They refused to acknowledge the injuries and harm that police dogs inflict, and they want to make dogs heroes instead of the weapons that they actually are in practice. They vowed to continue to criminalize vulnerable sex workers instead of protecting them, and they declared a war on science, evidence, public health, and common sense by denying heroin-assisted treatment and supervised injection services to people who use drugs who need these medical services. PIVOT will continue to fight through strategic litigation and law reform to counter policies and laws that lack compassion, go against evidence, and infringe constitutional and human rights. With your help, we will win that fight. Thank you.
And that was a discussion recorded this past week at Simon Fraser University, Woodward's campus, on the topic of heroin addiction and treatment. The panel was moderated by Connie Carter and included Dr. Gabor Maté, Dr. Bruce Alexander, Dave Murray, and Scott Bernstein. A link to the YouTube video mentioned by Dave Murray at the end of the discussion, Waiting for a Legal Shot, is available at our website, www.vcn.bc.ca/redeye.